Welcome, everyone, to Parshas Toldos in the year 5765. The Parsha takes us through various stages in the lives of the two brothers, twins, sons of Yitzchak and Rivka, the progenitors, one of the Jewish people, the other one of the descendants of Esav, also known as Edom, and many nations that may still be around today have vestiges of this nation. In fact, the exile in the Jewish history timeline, the exile that we are in is called the exile of Edom, and which is another name for Esav. And so, what we're looking at, says Rav Yerucham Lubavitz, who is our guide to the Chumash this year, says we're not just reading, we're reading a very long story with a lot of details, the story of two brothers, but this is not just a story of two brothers, this is a story of the entire scope of human history. And it is no less than that. And just to share with you a little conversation that Jack Horwitz and I had before class, Jack was perplexed by one of the episodes in the Parsha where Torah describes Yaakov and Esav. This was during their teens. And the Torah relates, this is in chapter 25, verse 29. Vayozed Yaakov Nazid, Vayovo Esav min hasadeh hu ayef. Yaakov boiled the stew, and Esav came in from the field, and he was exhausted. Vayomer Esav el Yaakov, haliteni no amin ho adom hazeh, ki oyef anochi. Esav said to Yaakov, pour into me now some of that very red stuff, for I'm exhausted. He therefore called his name Edom. Al-Kain Karashimo Edom. That's in fact where he got the other name, Edom, because Edom comes from the word, the color, Adom, red. Vayomer Yaakov, Michro Chayom es Bechoras Chali. Yaakov said, sell as this day your birthright to me. I'll give you some red stuff, brother, big brother, but I want something in return. I want to be the firstborn. Now, at that point, Jack asked me, isn't that a little deceptive? Isn't that coercion? Is that really befitting our father Yaakov to see his brother practically collapsing out of hunger and exhaustion and bribe him or extort him to sell something as important as the birthright? That does not seem very menschlich, if I could paraphrase. That doesn't seem like a menschlich thing to do. This was Jack's question. And I'm sure Jack and thousands of other people wonder that very same question. So I thought about it for a minute, and then I responded. And I responded with an approach based on a premise that Rav Lubavitch says. But I've heard it before. I think everyone who studies Chumash on a below-surface level tries to take this approach. That is, that the stories that we're reading about in the Chumash are not just cute stories between hungry brothers. But rather, as Rabbi Yerucham says, the reason why the Torah has this story is because this story and the story of the two brothers is the source for all of world history, as we started with, no less. The question and the answer is a question of nations. It's a timeless question that is still being asked today, and an answer which is still being answered. It's a question and answer which reverberates throughout the annals of history. What we have to understand is what was really the question and what was really the answer. I'm going to hold off on the answer that I gave to Jack until we have a little bit of Rav Yerucham's words to develop this theme. Starting from the beginning of the parsha, we have the conception and the birth, actually before the conception, of these twins. First, we're told at the beginning of the parsha that Yitzchak and Rivka were married, and they did not have any children. And they prayed feverishly to Hashem for a child, and finally Rivka conceived. Vayisrotzetzu habanim bekirbo. In verse 22, chapter 25. Vayisrotzetzu habanim bekirbo. What we're going to do is we're going to read some of the pesukim at the beginning of the story, the early years, and we're going to listen to Rav Yerucham's unparalleled insight into these events. And what he does is he opens a chumash and he reads the pasuk and he reads the Rashi, and then he tells us what it's really saying. Vayisrotzetzu habanim bekirbo. Vatomer im kein lomoze onochi vatelech lidrosh es Hashem. The children crushed within her. That's interesting translation. What does the Art Scroll Pentateuch say? Agitated? Okay. Same company, different translators. Vatomer, and she said, if so, why is it that I am? And she went to inquire of Hashem. Okay, now, the first word, Vayisrotzetzu, not such a common word. Rashi, on the spot, says, what is Vayisrotzetzu? He gives us two explanations. One, that Vayisrotzetzu comes from the word Ritza, or running, like Larutz. The children were running inside of her. How do you run inside of a womb? Not too much room in there.
No. Not much womb. Not enough womb.
Not so much womb. The other explanation is the word of misrotzitzim, or quarreling, or scuffling. Okay, so what does this mean? What is the meaning of running? What is the meaning of quarreling? These are just unborn fetuses that are lie dormant in the womb. Says Rav Yerucham, each of them tells us a profound insight about these two brothers. As far as Ritza is concerned, running, Rashi completes the picture, which is really found in Midrash, that whenever Rivka would pass by Pischei Torah Shel Shem Bo Ever, she would pass by the portals of Torah study. There were some yeshivas in those days. They didn't have dormitories, but they did have houses of study that were headed by descendants of Noach, Shem, and Ever. And whenever she would walk past one of them, she would feel Yaakov running and trying to break out and go to the yeshiva. He was drawn to it. And the same, on the other hand, whenever she would walk by houses, one of the houses of idol worship, of which there were plenty, she would feel the running because Esav was trying to get out.
How did she know which was?
She didn't. She didn't even know that she had twins. In fact, one of the commentaries has a beautiful explanation. It says, she says, Imkein lomo ze anochi, why am I? Or why do I exist for this? And then she went to the prophet, and the prophet told her, you have two nations in your womb. And she seems to have calmed down. And, you know, the question that the commentator asks is, what was bothering her so much? And what was the answer that settled her mind, put her mind at ease? And one answer is, she didn't know she had twins. She didn't know she had twins inside. She thought she had a single baby. And so she she's feeling this running to go out to the Beis HaMedrash, or the House of Torah Study, one day. The next day, running out to go to Avodah Zarah, to the House of Idol Worship. And she's saying, a mixed up kid. One day he's running towards the Torah, and the next day he's running towards idols. Im kein lama ze anochi. How can a person deal with somebody who's so schizophrenic? And she went to the Prophet, and the Prophet said, don't worry. It's not the same baby going both places, straddling the fence. It's two different people. And one has one nature, and the other one has a different nature. She says, ah, that I can deal with. You know, person who has a certain path, a certain leaning, so you deal with them for who they are. But a person who's undecided, a person who's on the fence, a person that that waffles back and forth, there's no hope for that person. And she was calmed. But what we see from here, going back to Rav Yerucham's insight, is this idea of nature. These are not people, these are not grown-ups, these are not even children. They're not even born babies. These are fetuses. They don't have yet the faculties of thought. They don't have the ability to think and to make a decision and to consider what are the good points, what are the bad points. What's going on that a fetus, an unborn baby, is running to the Beis Medrash? Or running to another baby is running to Avodah Zarah? That's something that you have to decide when you get a little older. You go out in the world and you see, you listen to the different, what each one has to offer. You listen to the Torah side and you consider whether it's something that grabs you, or you listen to the other side and you're caught up in their fervor. That's something for a grown-up to be making.
Not necessarily.
Yes?
The past 3 months of pregnancy, the stimuli can actually attract or detract the fetus. So maybe that stimuli has to make that decision for one, or the stimulus is passing the Avodah Zarah, stimulating it. We know that physiologically.
Okay. So Dr. Appelruth is saying that it is known, it has been proven clinically, that babies are affected by stimuli, even when they're in the womb, external stimuli. We probably have heard people that sing to their children in the womb, and what other kinds of things are done to stimulate. They read, right.
They go in the water. And
go in the water. Very interesting, very interesting. Well, Rav Yerucham basically says that, what you're saying, not based on clinical research, but based on the words of our Torah and our sages, that you see that not only is an external stimulus, such as sound or sight, or not sight, but sound or sensation, touch, stimulates a fetus, but even spirituality. Apparently, he's not suggesting that it was the sound, that they had any particular tunes in the Beis Medrash or in the House of Study, but it was the spirituality of it that stimulated them, which means to say that there is something inherent in the human soul that has a spiritual nature. Now, God made these two individuals, you know, from one extreme to the other. And it's very hard to find anyone as pure as Yaakov and anyone as impure as Esav. But what we see from the lesson, what we see from here is that spirituality is something of nature. It's something that is not merely a mental process. There's something innate. There's something that pulls us. There's something that you can't put into words. And that's true about us. And that is true about people in any level, you know, whether or not they're to the extreme of Yaakov or to the extreme of Esav, but we have a teva, and we can develop a teva. I thought of this in terms of what we had once talked about on Parshas Noach, where there's a pasuk that says that the inclination of man is evil from his youth. And the sages say, not from his youth, from the moment he's in the womb. He's already has instilled within him the evil inclination. And Rav Yerucha makes the same point, that it's something irrational, something internal, a teva, a nature, that pulls at us. And we see the same thing over here. Now we know that a person can change his teva. A person, you know, we're all brought into the world, we have an evil inclination, and at a certain age we start to develop a good inclination. Well, by repetition, by regularity, by practice, we can make it part of our nature. And that's really what happens to us, whether we like it or not. The choices that we make are not just for the rational faculty, but the choices that we make are actually changing our our internal makeup, our spiritual makeup, our nature. The notion of second nature, you know, people say that if you do something enough, it becomes second nature. The same thing is true in spirituality. And we shouldn't take it lightly. We shouldn't take lightly the things that we do, the choices that we make, because it's not just a one-time thing. The choices that we make today are going to be ingrained and added to our very nature, which is subconscious. So that's point number one. The other explanation, by Yisrotzitzu, that they were quarreling. Now, what this has in it is also a profound idea. Rav Yerucham says, again, the Rashi completes the words of the Midrash, they were quarreling with each other and arguing b'nachalat shnei olamos, with regard to the inheritance of the two worlds. They were arguing about olam hazeh, this world, and olam haba, the next world. That's what they were arguing about. These two little embryos are quarreling about this world and the next world. What does that mean? What does that mean? He says that we've got to do a reality check on our understanding of history, particularly in the area of the relationship of the Jews and the other nations. The notion of anti-Semitism. Where does anti-Semitism come from? Rav Yerucham says that he lived through many decades. He remembers being under the Russian regime. He remembers being under the German regime, the Nazi regime. And this regime had this particular campaign. Another regime had a different campaign. They would write articles in the newspapers, which if you read them, they wouldn't really make sense. They would be conflicting words. And if you look back in history, you see that there were different reactions to the Jews. When the Jews were adherent to their traditions, they would be said, nations would say about them, that they're holier than thou. When they would be more assimilated, they would be criticized for doing so. In other words, it doesn't make any sense. We have been accused of everything and its opposite. And what really, why do all of these campaigns attack us? For totally different reasons. What is the issue that makes us the target of criticism? And so what he says is, it's the same issue that was the target of the quarrel between Yaakov and Esav in the womb, which is nothing political, nothing social, nature. What do you think they were arguing about in there? Did they read the newspapers? Did they have governments? Was there politics inside the womb? No. Remember, they're unborn. All they have is a nature. He says there is no purpose, if I can quote his words, Ein tachlis lamilchama, there's no point to the war. The war is the point. In other words, the story of the Jew versus the other nations is not over any particular issues. It is the fact that there is an inherent, natural, spiritual conflict. And you see that from the fact that these two unborn babies who never read a newspaper in their life were fighting. That means that the root of the conflict, of the Jewish problem, is a natural, spiritual clash between one and the other. That is the explanation. And all of the other things, all of the political and the social and the current, whatever the current argument is, that's just the alibi. That comes after the fact. What can we do, say the nations, to justify our outrage against the Jews? If this fits into the current situation, then that will be our campaign. If it's something else, we'll use that. Whatever fits into the particular climate. That's not the cause of the conflict. The conflict is the ultimate cause. That there is a clash. And what is that clash over? Shnei Olamos. Who's going to have this world and who's going to have the next world? And he says, how come if it was just that they didn't want us to have this world, fine, so kill us. Why do they make decrees against our practice of religion? Why do the Greeks say that we cannot study Torah, that we can't circumcise our babies, that we cannot observe Shabbos and holidays? What do they care? Why is it bothering them? It's not taking away from this world at all. It's not making us richer or more powerful. That's our religion. Because they're arguing over this world and the next world. The conflict is so deep that they have a religious objection. They don't want to see us earning Olam Haba. Just like they don't want to see us having success in Olam Hazeh in this world. This is that the root of the clash. Yes?
Do they want to earn?
That's a very good question. I was wondering that myself.
Would you repeat that?
The question was, is it that they want to earn Olam Haba, or is it they don't want us to earn Olam Haba? Okay, that I think is going to be addressed by Jack's question. I will get to that soon. I want to go in chronological order, but we're going to come back to Mr. Horowitz's question. I think that relates to you as well. Yes.
In the womb, was the spirit that both had the same?
No.
Because in life, when one was superior, the other was down. One was up, the other was down.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were formed, when the descendants were formed, were they equal? Because in Olam Hazeh,
okay, my next comment, Dr. Appleruth is asking about the verse. A few psukim later, Rivka goes to the prophet, and the prophet tells her, there are two nations in your womb, two regimes from your inside shall be separated. One regime shall become strong from the other regime, and the elder shall serve the younger. So on the words, one regime shall be strong from the other, Rashi says, Lo yishvu begedula. They will never be equal in stature. Kishezekam zenofeil. When one rises up, the other one will fall. And vice versa. But they will never be equal. They will never be able to rule or to dominate at the same time. Okay, in other words, they can't share the crown, so to speak, of the world. Why is that? Rav Yerucham explains this as well. You see, these two brothers represent two different worldviews. And each worldview is a complete worldview. It's exclusive. Yaakov's worldview is that the whole purpose of this world is to pave the way and prepare ourselves for the world to come. To use this world as an opportunity to connect to God through Torah, through a life of Kedusha, of sanctity, and the purpose of all of the material blessing of the world is to enable us to have the wherewithal to serve God. So that encompasses every aspect of life. You know, every opportunity in life is either an opportunity to sanctify God, to have the choice. We have to be given a choice in order to sanctify God. So everything in life is there to test which way we will go. There is nothing in life that is without purpose. It doesn't, it's not there just for itself. It's as a means to sanctify God. The other worldview sees the world as having a different purpose. The world is a purpose of the here and now. Enjoy it. Get as much as you can. Whoever has more toys at the end of the game wins. Basically materialism, materialistic pursuit. And each of those is an entire worldview. It doesn't make room for the other. In the first worldview, where the world and the material of the world is for the purpose of giving man opportunity and the wherewithal to sanctify God, that's all it is. It's not for amassing materialism for its own sake. The worldview that says that the world is for the purpose of amassing materialism for its own sake doesn't have any room to sanctify God. We're too busy. We're too busy acquiring our materials. And so that's why Rav Yerucham says, the pasuk says, Ula'om yil'om yamatz. One regime will be stronger than the other. At any one time, one will be up, the other one will be down. In other words, they're mutually exclusive. You cannot have, not only are these two forces in conflict, but they cannot be reconciled. No way to be reconciled. There's no way these two forces can ever stop clashing. There's no way to make peace between Yaakov and Esau, because they represent two opposing forces which are mutually exclusive. And to translate that into, you know, our terms, you either see life as a platform for sanctifying God, or you see life as an end unto itself. And they mutually exclude one another.
Would this also apply to Yishmael?
I don't know. I'm not sure where Yishmael fits in. Yeah. I mean, he's a player. I don't know where he plays on the Yaakov and the Esav. He's before Yaakov and Esav.
And now he has a religious stance.
Yeah.
There's definitely
a role that Yishmael plays. I'm not sure where he fits into the paradigm of Yaakov and Esav. I know that Yishmael and Esav are thought to be in some way partners. Sometimes they fight against each other. Sometimes they're allies. I think in the prophecies, you know, of the end of days, it talks about the Esav and Yishmael joining forces, but I don't know theologically really what the representation of Yishmael is versus Esav. All I know is that Esav represents the antithesis of Yaakov. One, as we said, one sees the world for and solely for sanctification of God and connection with God, and that's what the material of the world is for, and the other one sees the material world as devoid of spirituality just for its own sake. Was Yishmael one of Esau's father-in-law? Yes. Good point. Interesting. So they're related. That's the source of their connection. Maybe now is a good time to reflect back on the verse that Jack said, which is, when Esav came in and said, in a very uncouth manner, pour into me now some of that very red stuff, for I am exhausted. Okay, somehow I don't, when I hear those words, I don't picture like a prim and a proper, you know, person sitting down and, you know, tucking in his napkin and saying, you know, excuse me, please, may I have something to eat? But you see a very grub individual wanting something and wanting it now. As you said, instant gratification.
There's a lot written though on why he was so famished and tired.
True.
And then also the mental super, it goes into about Abraham died.
Right. So we can't go into all of the midrash behind that. But just these words and the way that he spoke, every word in this verse jumps out at you. Uncouthness, pour into me now. Pour into me now. Very red stuff. I mean, every single word is like worse than the previous one. And Yaakov is listening to this and says, Esav, you're the Bechor. You're the firstborn. You were born into the position of being the next patriarch. Are you sure you want that responsibility? Are you sure you want to be the follower of the successor of our father Yitzchak to bring the world to the sanctification of God? And you still look at the world this way, so materialistic and so grub, so instant, and everything is now, and I need it now? And that's why he said, sell, as this day, your birthright to me. As if to say, you can't have both. You can't have both. You can't have this world as an end of itself and also the birthright. Which one will it be, Esav? So he says, look, I'm going to die. So what use to me is a birthright? There you have his answer. He says, I'm not living for a birthright. I'm living for today. And therefore Yaakov says, fine. If you want today, if you want instant gratification, here it is. But you can't have the birthright. You'll have to sell that to me. Because you can't have it both ways. That's what he was doing. He wasn't. This is not some kind of extortion to get something, take advantage of somebody who's weak in a position of hunger and to extort him. That's not what's going on over here. We're talking about the world view. Esav wants to have it on a silver platter. He wants to have this world now for its sake, and he's not interested in the spiritual view of the world.
So then you would think that the answer to my question would be no, they don't.
I'm sorry?
Then you would think that the answer to my question would be no, they don't.
Right. But, interestingly enough, here, thank you. Thank you for bringing me back to that. So, if Esav doesn't want the world to come, why is he fighting?
Because he sees that Yaakov has something that he doesn't have. There's something intangible, and something, it occurs to him that there's something more, and he doesn't have it.
And therefore, he doesn't want Yaakov to have it either.
Right.
He wants to deny that there even is a world to come. That's what Esav is fighting for. I don't want you to have this world, because I want it. And I don't want you to have the world to come, because I don't want there to be a world to come. Because if there is a world to come, then my life is a lie. So I don't want you to have it either. Exactly.
So have they? I would say that in history, in the last 2,000 years, we would try to see that the Goyim have figured out a way to try to have it here and there, try to live a life here, that many of them are using a veil, potentially, of having, you know, certain decency here and still hoping for something there, but yet trying to have both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I was just thinking, as you said that, maybe that's the role of Yishmael. Maybe Yishmael has a certain spirituality to it, and Esav wants to hook into that. I don't know. It's just conjecture. I really don't have, in my own experience of learning, I never really got any explanation of the Yaakov and the Esav and the Yishmael, but I'm very, very, it's on my to-do list, to-learn list. Okay, a couple of more points about the Yaakov and the Esav. You know, we already have we know where this is going. We see what this rivalry is. We see that this is a clash of worldviews. What are some of the symptoms? And by the way, Rav Yerucham doesn't stress this, but anyone that I've ever heard speak about Esav says that we have to all recognize that although we descend from Yaakov, but we also have the Yetzer Hara, we also have the evil inclination, you know, which is, I mean, Esav's, he's the concentrate. We have a little, maybe a little dose. So we have to know how Esav operates too, because we have to realize that there's a little bit of Esav inside of us. So we have to know exactly what are the, you know, the symptoms and what are the features, the attributes. So one thing is, in the verse, he brings out in the verse, "Vayigdulu hane'arim," and the children grew up. Where was that?
Verse 27.
Thank you. "Vayigdulu hane'arim," the lads grew up. "Ve'ayah Esav ish yodeat sayid ish sadeh, ve'Yaakov ish tom yoshev holim." Esav became a man who knows trapping, a man of the field, but Yaakov was a wholesome man abiding in tents. Okay, in just a moment we'll explain the idea behind a man who knows trapping, a man of the field, and also wholesome man abiding in tents, in just a moment. But one thing you see before you get to that, it says, "Vayigdulu hane'arim," which means the lads grew up. And then Esav became who he was and Yaakov became who he was. But it sounds like that during their early years, you couldn't tell. They were just the lads, and they were both growing up, and they were cute little boys. Rav Yerucham says, "What a pachad! An awesome or a scary thought to think that there are natures, very very strong natures within us, and tendencies, and yet you cannot necessarily tell when you look at a child which way it goes." And he says, you know, there's a lot of scientific study and research going on about how to be able to detect the inner nature of something, either chemically or genetically. He says, we should put our research time and energy into the human laboratory and to try, as we have children, to try to educate children. That we try very hard to really get a good handle on their natures. And they may not come out in younger years, but they're already there from the womb. And we should try to hook into it so that we can help guide that child from the earliest age according to their teva, according to their nature. And even two as radically different could still not be detected at the youngest age. That's a note on education. Now, these two features here. So Esav was a man who knows trapping, a man of the field. Yaakov was wholesome, and he abided in tents. These two, each one having his two descriptive phrases about him, reveal to us the essential nature of these people and of these prototypes. First we have trapping versus wholesomeness. And Rashi expounds on this. Trapping is not just being a hunter and hunting animals, but trapping is the idea, lotsud uloramos es oviv, to trap and to deceive other people, to be deceptive. Esav used to ask his father halachic questions. How does one tithe salt and straw? And his father thought that he was medakdek b'mitzvah, that he was meticulous in mitzvah performance. To be contrasting that to Yaakov, who was an ish tam, wholesome. And wholesome means that he wasn't deceptive. He did not. He said, he spoke straight. Now, a person who is not so, one who is not sharp in deceiving is called wholesome. So here we have one point that Esav is deceptive, Yaakov is wholesome. Rav Yerucham says as follows. First of all, it doesn't mean that Yaakov wasn't smart. Yaakov was very smart. Yaakov knew how to deceive. Later on, he says to when he gets involved in the charade of appearing before his father as Esav, there's a verse there that says, "I'm his rival when it comes to deception." Yaakov says about himself, "I can be just as deceptive as he, but it's not my nature. It goes against my grain. I'm wholesome." Wholesome means that your mouth and your heart are aligned. You don't, by nature, you don't like to say that which you don't mean. And you don't like to speak words that are not in consonance with what is inside of you. Esav, on the other hand, would say one thing and think another. Now here's where Rav Yerucham says something which just shakes me up. This Rashi that says he used to ask his father halachic questions. I've always understood this to mean that he really didn't care, he didn't even bother with tithing, but he wanted his father to think that he did. And so he said, "Father, how do you tithe the salt?" And really he didn't even tithe the salt. Rav Yerucham says, no, doesn't mean that he didn't tithe the salt. You think Yitzchak was so blind? Esav did tithe the salt. And that's why he used to ask his father questions, because he really wanted to know, because he had to do it. So where's the deception? The deception was he did the mitzvahs. He did the mitzvahs. But he wasn't a mitzvah person. He did it, but it wasn't in consonance with his essence of who he was. Spiritually, he wasn't there. He did the mitzvahs because, you know, he said, "I'm a Jew too, I'm a son of Yaakov, I'll do it, I'll go through the motions." He was deceptive in the sense that he never brought his action together with his heart. Wholesome means that you truly live by what you do. That your mouth, that your deeds are in consonance with your heart. That's one thing. The difference between wholesomeness and trapping. The other point is being in the field or being in the tent. Now, simply, we think of that Esav was more physical and Yaakov was more spiritual. Says Rav Yerucham, that is not the interpretation of Unkelus, the Aramaic translation. Gevar nach shirchan. I'm not sure what that word means myself, but Rav Yerucham says it means that a man of the field means a man batel, leisure. He was a man that liked to take it easy. Yaakov was a man of the tent. It's not just that it was the tent of Torah. That's not the only point. It was that in the tent of Torah, you have to put forth effort. You have to work hard. It's the difference between being somebody who tries, someone who strives, someone who searches and seeks to grow versus somebody that just stays where he is and takes the easy route. That is the essential difference between Yoshev Ohalim and Ish Sadeh. And Ish Sadeh is a person that likes to take it easy. I am who I am. That's it. And Ish Ohalim, Yoshev Ohalim, is a person that says, I am who I am now. But boy, am I going to work hard to strive to become more than I am now. That is the represented by the tent. So here we have two very important points of the difference, the symptoms of a personality that is living with the worldview of purpose. This world is the purpose to strive for spiritual, for spirituality, for a connection with God, to sanctify God, versus a person with the worldview of materialism for the here and now. One point is, is your action and your speech in consonance with your heart? Are you true through and through? Or is there disunity? Are you acting one way, but inside you're another way? That's one point. And the second point is, how much effort are you putting into it? Are you just complacent, happy to stay where you are? Take it easy, then you're a man of the field. If you want to work, if you want to improve, if you want to grow, then you're a dweller of the tents. These are some of the important, the fundamental attributes of Yaakov and Esav, which once again, they're not just two brothers, but they are the two poles of personality in the world, and not just personalities, but two approaches to this world and indeed the world to come.
Shkoyah.
Yes.
The tent is a metaphor for introspection. I mean, how is the tent?
It may have been. I mean, the tent really means the tent of learning. But the most profound part of learning is growing. So that's why I say it's not just, you know, whether you're reading a book or not. When we talk about learning, we talk about learning in terms of growing. And the reason why we learn is because we want to advance. We want to change. We want to grow. We want to improve. We don't want to just stay where we are. You know, so a person should be learning. A person can be learning throughout their day, throughout their life, whatever they're doing. You can be learning in the workplace. You can be learning at home. You can be learning at the synagogue. You can be learning wherever you are. I'm saying that is, in essence, what a tent dweller is. And a man of the field is a person that just likes to take in the scenery. But life is not about changing myself. Life is just about, you know, enjoying the material pleasures that I have available to me.
Char is a man of
the man. Well, it literally means the man of the field. Batel means batel means leisure. It means bitul, wasting, right? Idle. Idle.
Right.
Question on semantics, Rabbi. You said that Jacob's mission in life was to sanctify God. But I've also heard the expression, you should sanctify God's name. And to me, there is a difference. Conceptually, it doesn't sound right to me to sanctify God, because God is perfect.
Right. Well taken. I'm not sure the difference, but when we say sanctify God, we mean, as we mentioned in the context of Abraham, God is only exists in our world when there are people that live for Him. Without Abraham, God didn't exist in the world. He existed, but He didn't exist in the world. He wasn't in the world because nobody recognized Him. So it's as if God isn't there. It's like
the tree falls in the forest.
Right? It's like God isn't here. It takes a person for God to be in the world. And that's what Abraham introduced. He was the only one that said, God is here. So that's what sanctified. Yeah, there were people before him. Abraham actually did more than that. First of all, he recognized it on his own. And second of all, He decided that since he knew about God in the world, he couldn't just keep it to himself. He had to share it with everyone else. Mm.